This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Robert Francis from Johns Hopkins University. Robert's a graduate student there and the author of a forthcoming article in Socius, Him Not Her, Why Working Class White Men Reluctant About Trump Still Made Him President of the United States. Thank you for joining us, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
So can you start off by telling us a little bit about this forthcoming piece?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. So I should say to start maybe that my overriding interests are actually in sort of the declining labor force participation among the working class, particularly younger working class men. So I was in the field for that project and had no sort of plan to think about policy or politics. It just so happens, though, that I happened to start my field work in the summer of 2016, just before the conventions, you know, and so here I am in rural Pennsylvania talking to the white working class, and this election thing is happening. And so for my initial respondents that I talked to that summer, I actually didn't really talk much about the election. It sort of came up tangentially a little bit, but, you know, it wasn't part of my original research. And you know, frankly, I think probably like a lot of people, I thought, you know, in 6 months, you know, we'll all happily put Trump as a footnote to history. And there's no really need to ask these guys about how they feel about the soon to be Republican nominee. Well, of course, turns out 6 months later, I go back to the field in January, just before the inauguration of President Trump. And suddenly, you know, everyone is interested, not just in Trump, but in the white working class and this narrative that sprung up really the day after the election, and even to some degree before that, about, you know, the role that the white working class played in his election. So when I was back in the field in January and again in March, talking to more of these white working class men, I then did ask explicitly about the election and why, who they voted for and why. And so I then gathered this data, but it still wasn't my primary focus. And then Socius, you know, I guess thankfully they put out a call for papers on gender in the election. And so I was able to sort of use that as the incentive to write up what I had found.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think, I mean, the main takeaway is that I found a lot more reluctance about Trump among these men than I think is often depicted in some of the scholarly and popular depictions of this group. You know, it seems like most of the debate kind of post-election assumes that the white working class were attracted to Trump, and the debate has really been about whether it was economic anxiety or racial resentment or what combination of those things is really at play. But sort of under both of those is that Trump really appealed to these guys in a unique way. And you know, I of course, I can't dispute, you know, I have a small end sample, it's a small study, but I found a lot more sort of wide-eyed approach to Trump. They really saw him a bit for what he was. They were unsure of him. They had their reasons to sort of suspect him, and they just weren't sure. They weren't sure about Trump, and there was a reluctance about him. And so, my first finding, as I sort of read through these transcripts, was just this idea that, you know, there's all this reluctance. But then when I asked them who they voted for, when I tallied that up, you know, most of them still voted for Trump. And so then for me, that was the puzzle, is despite all the stated reluctance, why did they vote for him? And, you know, for me, what seemed clear is that, you know, Clinton was sort of even more objectionable. She was the worst choice. So I think maybe that sort of leads me to the conclusion that we're sort of in a way underselling Trump's opponent and some of the dynamics around Clinton as the alternative candidate. And, you know, there's a lot we can unpack there. Maybe I'll come up for air and see. I haven't, since this hasn't been published yet, I'm really curious what you guys think about it.
So from what you've said so far, it brings up a couple of questions for me, right? So the first is, you know, you talk about their skepticism. What about him were they skeptical about? I mean, I know for me, part of it is that, like, I grew up in New York under the shadow of Trump. And, you know, number one, I was just like, first of all, I don't know how anyone can take him seriously. It also seemed to me that, you know, in thinking about Trump and his glitz and his glamour and, you know, and his, like, unabashed, like, flaunting of his wealth, what could anyone from the working class actually see in him as being a true champion, especially as reports were coming out that, you know, he screwed so many of his workers who were their working class compatriots.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And obviously, I share some of that incredulity. But I think for these guys, Trump sort of represented, I mean, they talked a lot about him as the businessman, as an outsider politically. And again, this is where I think, you know, in analyses of the election that don't include sort of what Clinton also represented to some of these voters is that, you know, I think they were looking for a change candidate. They were looking for someone who was from outside the system. And I think, you know, as I mentioned in the paper, many of them did say they would have voted for Sanders or considered Sanders. I just think they, you know, Trump, you know, yeah. So I get some of the dissonance of, you know, what Trump represents for some, but for these guys, he, I think they emphasize the sense of a business leader and someone coming from outside the system. And, you know, Clinton for them, even though she was the first female nominee of a major party, you know, she also represented sort of a sense of status quo, a sense of, you know, political corruption, of even financial corruption. They have sort of in a way been dealing with her for decades. She was obviously a known entity for many of them. And I think, you know, the dislike of her goes back, you know, long before this campaign cycle. So I think in a binary choice, they sort of, in a way, I mean, they saw that it was a risk. Many of them talked about how Trump, you know, it was like rolling the dice in a certain way. But I guess for their calculus, at least for the ones who were conflicted, I mean, I did have some voters who, you know, they weren't thrilled with Trump, with some of his behavior or some of his excesses, but they saw some of the risks that he posed, but they, you know, they were Republican voters or they were pro-life voters, or, you know, it seemed to me in my conversations with them that they were never really, you know, seriously considering a non-Trump alternative, you know, voting for the Democrat basically. But I did have some guys who, again, voted for Obama or, you know, told me that they would have really preferred an alternative to Trump, but in the end, they just really saw an equivalence between, you know, the corruption of Trump and Hillary. And so for them, they went with the political outsider, the guy with no record, the guy, you know, who might shake things up or represents a change.
Yeah. So I know you did your research basically starting around the convention. So you didn't have access to people during the primary. But did you notice any distinction between the primary voters and people who were like, well, I would have rather support Rubio or Cruz or whomever. But you know, ultimately, I have to go with the nominee, you know, because I've noticed that in, like, you know, seeing people that there was a big difference between people who were, you know, favored him among the other candidates and kind of like once he got the nomination, reluctantly kind of came home to the party. And you can see this systematically in some of the survey data in that, like, evangelical Protestants who had high church attendance tended to support Cruz in the primary. And those who, or you know, earlier on some of the other candidates, whereas evangelical Protestants who don't attend church were a very strong Trump constituency from very early.
So with my data, I didn't ask all of them who they voted for in the primary, so I can't probably make fully answer the question. But what I can say is that, you know, I did have a few guys in my sample who were first-time voters who voted for Trump. So they were the sort of, you know, I guess, so, you know, for those, there is some percentage of the population, of the white working class population, that did respond, you know, uniquely to Trump's message. And both of these guys in my sample were clear that they would not have voted for anyone else. So they certainly would qualify as folks who were Trump supporters in the primary and stayed with Trump in the general. And it is true, I think they were the ones among my respondents who talked a little bit more about trade and immigration than others. So, you know, this might, I mean, I have to be careful not to generalize, but I think, you know, anecdotally speaking, I think those are the ones who seem to speak more about Trump's message versus some of the other guys who seem to speak about, you know, Trump's, the risks that Trump posed, and then again, sort of came around. And I did have also a few guys, speaking of the evangelical piece, I mean, there were several men who were, they identified as evangelical, and they did talk explicitly about their pro-life commitments and how that was important. And I do think, you know, obviously that's an important, they didn't talk about the court explicitly, but there is this sense that, you know, the sort of capture of the Republican Party of this vote over the last 30 or 40 years, you know, that these guys, I think, are default Republican voters on a couple of these issues, you know, Second Amendment issues and pro-life issues. And so in that sense, their default is to support the GOP nominee. And so they talked about more of those issues, those sort of culture war issues.
Yeah, it reminds me a little of this meme that's going around among anti-Trump Republicans. Whenever he does something especially awful. So every 4 hours, you'll see somebody posts this picture of there's this flood that's like swallowing a city. It's a photograph. And then there's like this sign just barely visible poking above the water. And it says, but Gorsuch. So.
Yeah.
I wonder how much. Well, were your guys interested in the Supreme Court? Did that figure into their calculus?
I mean, no one mentioned it explicitly. And so in that sense, I don't know how closely they were tracking that, but a few mentioned the sort of pro-life issue as important. I think the thing, as I think about this group of men, I mean, they're, again, the thing that struck me, I did have sort of, I mean, and, you know, you have on the sort of base voters who seem to be, you know, either staunchly Republican or, you know, they were going to follow through and vote for whoever the Republican nominee was. And you had, again, these few guys who Trump, you know, presented a unique appeal for. But then I think the majority of the ones who actually voted were conflicted about the vote. And that's where I just feel like, as I think about what these results might mean, I mean, it's a small sample, but maybe we've underplayed the sort of degree to which, you know, Hillary as the opposition was just, for various reasons, and we can sort of unpack what those might be, but, you know, she just was not an acceptable choice, but these guys really did not want to vote for Trump. And I did have, you know, some who voted third party and some who didn't vote at all. And so they just were conflicted about it, which is not what I expected to find, because I think a lot of the reporting sort of post-election, especially, I mean, the journalistic accounts where they go to a Trump rally and talk to Trump. So, I mean, of course, that's like a sampling on a dependent variable or, and, you know, there's been all this reporting too. I mean, all the discussion about the Nazi next door piece in the New York Times recently. I mean,
yeah,
you know, that's a whole nother topic, but part of me, you know, I sort of want to say, well, that's not representative. I mean, we know that, right. Is this, we're giving a lot of space to sort of these extremes, but even in among these guys, I'm finding, just, you know, maybe more reluctance and more sort of concern about Trump than is being, you know, depicted. I mean, we see it in some of the, as Gabriel says, we see it in some of the poll numbers. We know that, you know, Trump has a base, but that he's been, you know, consistently running, you know, he's quite unpopular, and we know that his support is soft after a certain point. So I'm sort of, I mean, maybe what I'm capturing in some ways is some of that softness in the polling numbers. And I'm sort of curious to project ahead. And I mean, I'm not in the prognostication business, but just wondering, you know, come 2018 or come 2020, what's going to kind of come of some of these guys who were really concerned and in some ways gave Trump a pass because he didn't have a political record. As Leslie points out, he certainly had a record, and whether these guys chose to just look past it or sort of give him the benefit of the doubt as a non-politician, I think then, you know, in 4 years, he will have a record to run on if he does run in 2020. And, you know, I'm sort of curious how these guys will reassess the risks that they took in voting for him.
Okay, yeah. So Robert, I wanted to follow up on what you just said, because my original question to you had to do with the skepticism of the men that you were speaking with. You mentioned their skepticism and their reluctance. And I was just, you know, wondering, like, can you give us specifics about their skepticism? What were they skeptical about? What were they worried about? Why were they reluctant? And then also have a second question, which has to do with your title, Him, Not Her. To what extent do you think gender actually played a role and they're not wanting to vote for Clinton? I mean, there were many reasons not to vote for Clinton, and you mentioned some of them, but I'm wondering whether or not gender was also one.
Sure. Two great questions. I think with the first question, I think most of these men, they seemed concerned that Trump was just erratic and reckless. Many talked about a vote for him as essentially a roll of the dice. So I think men, you know, some of the things you would expect, they questioned his fitness for the job, whether he would do a good job. They said he was a showman and a celebrity, but not necessarily someone that they could trust. So I think it's some of the
same things. I have no idea where they were getting all that from.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that struck me in sort of answering this is just the fact that, I mean, one of the narratives post-election is how attractive Trump was to many of these guys. And, you know, there might be some element of that. It's, you know, below the surface, or maybe explicitly for some. But then there's also this piece about these men maybe were duped or they didn't see the things that we all saw. And I think that certainly wasn't true, or at least, you know, they were very clear at some of the risks that Trump posed. Obviously, they weighted things a little differently in the fact that they ultimately voted for him. But I think it was striking to me that they did sort of see, they were wide-eyed about Trump in a way that, you know, I mean, the Clinton campaign in a sense banked on the fact that they could convince everyone that Trump was unfit. And what's funny is that these guys really did see that. But obviously they made a different decision than the Clinton campaign would have wanted.
During the election, I remember, you know, the common thing to say, and it was totally true, was that the Democrats nominated the only person who could lose to Trump and the Republicans nominated the only person who could lose to Clinton. I mean, these were two, if you compare the candidate quality to 2012, where, you know, the Democratic candidate was pretty good and the Republican candidate was pretty good. Both of them were obviously qualified for office. And neither of them seem to be, you know, creeps or, you know, or avaricious or, you know, crazy or anything like that, right? You basically had two fundamentally decent, responsible, qualified people, you know, whereas you can make a pretty strong argument that both candidates were not ideal, even if you say that one was, you know, leaps and bounds more stable than the other. In this most recent
Or more qualified for the job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the one did have a background in public service and did not seem fundamentally crazy, even if she did seem somewhat, you know, venal. Yeah,
corrupt.
Yeah, it's interesting on the gender piece because I've frankly struggled a lot with that in the writing of the piece and even since then. I mean, it's in a way tricky to tease out what sort of gender bias or sexism, either explicitly or implicitly, look like here. I mean, I didn't have sort of the Mad Men style sexism for the most part. I mean, a few guys said some pretty sexist things, but they actually turned out to be some of my non-voters. So I did have non-voters in among this group. So even though they had some terrible things to say, they wouldn't have influenced the outcome. You know, I obviously didn't do any sort of deep dive about their views about women or women in politics. I'm not, you know, testing those sorts of things, but it was kind of surprising that there wasn't, or not surprising, it was notable that there wasn't as much sexism as one might expect. But then that said, sexism isn't always, it doesn't always announce itself as such. And so the role of gender, you know, in some ways is hard to tease out here. I did title it Him, Not Her, because there was, you know, this thing about Clinton. I mean, a lot of them talked about she wasn't trustworthy, she was a liar, these sorts of things. But then, you know, it's tricky because, you know, there's a lot of people on the left who had, you know, who were concerned about Clinton, who had similar critiques. And so I want to be fair to these guys and not sort of assume because they're white working class men that when they say they don't trust Clinton, it's sexism. But when a progressive says, I don't trust Clinton, that it's somehow vindicated. So,
I don't know. I mean, because what I remember basically the day after the election, you know, there were lots of conversations going on around it wasn't about the sexism of white working class men. Some of the conversations I heard were about how that sexism is so pervasive that white middle and upper class suburban women voted for Trump over Clinton. So, I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that, that because they're white and working class, that they're more likely, to be sexist.
That thing about, you know, the women is absurd because it sets as a counterfactual that obviously they should have voted for the candidate who's more demographically like them and shows less personal boorishness towards their group. But so if you think in that way, that's surprising that this constituency ultimately swung towards Trump. But if you just think of it as that is a strong Republican constituency baseline, and then it's like dog bites man to say Republican constituency votes for Republican candidate.
It's true, but Republican women suffer from sexual harassment and sexual assault. This just the same as Democratic women do, right? And so I think that's actually one of the people thought that the things that he'd said and the fact that there were so many allegations against him, like, you know, including from his ex-wife concerning this, people, I think, assumed that, you know, that those
women would
last week, or was it the week before, that we were talking about the reevaluation of Bill Clinton? and how people have been, and how people had been going back to this issue of, like, you know, looking at how people thought about it in the 90s and saying, wow, this is kind of gross, to saying, like, you know, not having Al Gore as president is worth setting a double standard and undermining, you know, the reconceptualization of sexual harassment that happened prior to 1998 throughout the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, no, partisanship is the most powerful force in the universe. That's all I'm saying. And so you shouldn't be shocked if, you know, Democratic women still support Bill Clinton, or if Republican women still support Donald Trump.
In the American political
universe. Well, in the American political universe since the 1990s, right? If you go back to the 70s, the United States was not nearly as partisan, and there might be other places where partisanship isn't as strong, although I know partisanship has been increasing in many other Western democracies, including Britain.
Robert, how big a factor was Fox News and that type of stuff, Breitbart and Drudge, and in your guys' sort of universe of information?
Yeah, it's a good question. I didn't really probe that too much with them. I mean, these are sort of open-ended interviews without much of a script to them. So I was really just asking, you know, who they voted for and why, and letting them sort of tell me. So I don't really have a lot of insight into that. I do suspect that it's maybe in some ways less influential than some might think. I mean, I didn't get a lot of the talking points that one would maybe have expected if someone were just sitting in front of the TV all day and just regurgitating. Because again, you know, what I heard about Trump was, for the most part, reluctance, in a few cases, a little bit of favorableness around a couple of his policies. But for the most part, they were just quite concerned about what a Trump presidency might look like. So in that sense, you know, I wasn't getting the true believers, which again, just for me, the top line finding is this idea that there, you know, just was this reluctance I didn't expect to find, especially with some of the popular reports about Trump's great appeal to the white working class and how successful that was, mm-hmm. and historic. And, you know, when you get these dispatches from Trump rallies and places like that, then it's easy to sort of, you know, and I, on that point, I should say it's easy to take that and to sort of just, like, you know, paint the entire white working class with this sort of Trump enthusiasm.
Well, so on this issue of enthusiasm, one of the things that was different, and, you know, you can kind of see, like, the Bannon strategy and stuff like that cash out, and what ultimately swung the Electoral College was that turnout was different. You know, one way that turnout was different, and it's worth appreciating because it was just as important as what I'm about to say, is that Black turnout went down to historic levels rather than at its extraordinarily elevated rates that you saw in both of Obama's elections. But, you know, on the other side, non-college white turnout was much higher than it had been, especially in Rust Belt states. And that does seem to have made the decision in those states that unexpectedly swung in the, you know, industrial Midwest. So that would be indicative on first glance, not of a hold your nose type approach, but of a certain amount of enthusiasm. And so it's interesting to contrast that with this, you know, these people don't seem to be naive about, you know, the guy they're voting for being, you know, to put it charitably, erratic. How can there be people, and not that I'm doubting you, right? But how can you have people who are, in recognition that this person is erratic and not really qualified, and the lesser of two evils as they perceive it, and yet still turn out when they didn't turn out to vote for, say, Mitt Romney, or for that matter, necessarily Barack Obama, right? That is to say, people who, by any reasonable standard, are much more better character and better qualified, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's actually a new paper by Steve Morgan at Hopkins and a co-author. They use the CPS and the GSS to sort of establish what you're talking about, that there was sort of a modest bump. I think they find a 3-4% bump in white working class turnout in the competitive states. So there is evidence, as you're pointing out, that there is some elevation there. And so I've thought about that. I mean,
but you talk about,
go ahead.
Sorry, you talk about people who Trump moved, like some of your guys were moved to vote for Trump and vote for the first
time. Yeah, that's right. And I guess, I mean, it's hard for me with a small end sample to say sort of what's going on. I mean, but I think to your point, Joe, I, you know, one way of maybe reconciling these things is to say that, you know, there was some some portion of the electorate who were uniquely motivated by Trump. And the fact that I have a few in a relatively small sample, I can't generalize statistically, but the common sense inference is if it wasn't too hard to find these guys in my study, then there's probably a lot more of them out there. And so maybe that makes the margin, I mean, again, we're talking a few percentage points, but that's enough with the depressed turnout and other demographics. So, you know, maybe those are, I mean, the, again, I think a lot of people have puzzled over, not that Trump got to, you know, 25% or 30%, but how he got to 40 and then ultimately to whatever it was, 46.1% of the vote. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of types of folks in there. I mean, what is it, whatever it is, 60 million people voted for Trump. So there's a lot of different types of things going on in there. So, yeah, even looking at my small study, I mean, some portion of that are people who were uniquely motivated for him. But then I think what I'm sort of sensing is maybe, and you know, I can turn this back over to the data scientists and to say, you know, maybe we should pay a little bit more attention to the sort of soft middle or the apathy or some of this reluctance. And I'm just sort of curious looking forward how this might play out down the road if it is indeed the case.
I just have a question for you about your interviews with these men in general, like, you know, politics aside, you know, what seem to be their primary concerns?
So the bigger project I mentioned earlier is what I'm actually interested in is the fact that we have, you know, good evidence that, and this is a long run trend, that, you know, men are dropping out of the labor force, especially, white working class men and working class men of prime age. So when we'd really expect them to be in the labor market. So I've been really, my main interest is in sort of, you know, their experiences in the labor market. And so that's actually what sort of the bulk of these interviews is really focusing on, sort of their lives and what they're up to. And, you know, I think many of these guys, their lives don't look all that different if you really are up close with them. I mean, they're trying to make a living. They have kids and families. And actually, I found in some degree, I mean, there is a lot of precarity and anxiety out there, I think. But, you know, they also, I think, are pretty content in some ways, right? I didn't find as much anxiety as maybe one might think. I think these guys are just trying to make their way in the world. So it's sort of to be continued on their labor market prospects and situations. So I guess, you know, check back in a year or two, and hopefully I have a final dissertation about the declining labor force participation among this population. But, you know, this foray into politics was not sort of the intent, but, you know, hopefully the paper, when it launches, can at least add a little bit of texture to this conversation. It's in a way sort of crazy that it's, you know, over a year after, and we're still in a sense litigating what happened.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of The Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.